We get the second hour underway on this 40th anniversary of the murder of John Lennon by welcoming in our friend Colin Fleming, author of the wonderful new book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
Well, doing what we do this afternoon. First of all, Carrie and I were talking about it earlier. It's hard to process that it's been 40 years since John Lennon was killed.
Were you watching that Monday Night Football game when the news came out?
I was. Like much of America, I heard the news first from Howard Cosell.
And my dad really detested Howard Cosell. He was a bit before my time, and I've only seen him now like in YouTube videos. But, of course, that's a super famous one, right? So not an easy bit of news to deliver to people getting their pigskin fixed.
No, and I saw somebody posted, and I don't recall seeing this, a video today of Howard actually interviewing Lennon during a Monday night game back in 1974, and it was very entertaining.
Yeah, I know about that. Cosell was, I think the reason my dad probably didn't like him was that he was somewhat arrogant, and he was well-spoken, though. He was someone who, you don't have a lot of that today, that sort of old-school broadcaster who was also a factotum, like this pundit, and was clearly well-read and articulate and all those things. So a no-nonsense straight shooter, which would have appealed to Lennon when Lennon was being his most honest self, I would say.
Well, you wrote a terrific piece about John Lennon and the 40th anniversary of his death, and the fact that you believe, and I would agree with you strongly, that song, Help, is the most honest song that Lennon ever recorded.
A full-throated shout, really. And when you played the bit of sound there, it even with the connection and the cell phone and everything, it reaches out and it grabs you, shakes you, and it has this unbridled need and earnestness and passion to it that is, I was in a cafe, and this is what I had mentioned in the Wall Street Journal piece, and came over the sound system, and it just is so unlike anything that you encounter, not just in music right now, it's unlike anything you encounter sociologically, that somebody is going to speak that plainly and is going to do a kind of emotional denuding, which is not what we get in this society where it's all about the pose and the stage management and making yourself look like you're living a certain life that you're really not. And that's laborious and it's draining. And the way that Lennon sings this song and the character he embodies, it sounds to me like it's someone singing not just for help with a third party, with a friend or whatnot, but really to themselves. It's kind of like way to, like sometimes I'll speak to myself on the blog and I'll address myself and be like, it's not like this royal we, but I guess if you really didn't know what was going on, it could come across that way. But it's a way of trying to get myself to talk to myself, to rally myself, to hold fast and to have courage. And that's really what that song is the sound of.
And it was so courageous, I would say, for Lennon to do that at that time and at that place in his career.
It's funny you should mention that because someone said that to me today about something I had written on the blog. They're like, that's courageous. And I wonder if Lennon would have looked at his expression, his kind of emotional outing of himself that way as courageous, because I don't know if it really registers to you when you're the one who's saying something that's simply true about your life. I think we look at that as courageous when we are loath to do that ourselves, to take that jump, to take the running start and go off the cliff and hit the water that's deep enough below us. I think if you're actually the person who takes the running start and goes off the cliff and hits that water down below and it's deep enough to take you, that you don't look at it as courageous. You look at it as something that you do or that you have to do. And it resonates, that's really the paradox of it. It resonates with other people as something courageous, which is what makes it empowering for them, which is what makes it inspiring.
And a lot of people will point to Imagine as perhaps the most famous Lennon solo effort and maybe even the most inspirational. You would take issue with that.
I would. Imagine is dejune. It's insincere. It's not who this person was, and I am careful to make a divide between who a person is and their art, because we've spoken about this before. I don't think Lennon was a particularly good person. He's someone who's art resonated with me, particularly when I was younger. And he's probably still my favorite musician. I've kind of outgrown certain aspects of what he was about, and I've found that I've moved on to other people that really didn't quite have the same impact upon me before. But I think that that was his woke social justice warrior, get a sort of cheap overall prevailing like going, like we get on Facebook, that type of thing. And it's just not Lenin. It's very amorphous. It's not specific. It's not dialed in with that humanness that means so much, not just to me, but I think is a kind of undergirding of all great art. It has to have the humanness. And the reason Imagine it has so much play right now is because it doesn't really say anything. There's no specificity to it. There's no emotional specificity. And in a culture where we can just project whatever we want onto the blank wall and own it as, well, it's my truth, Imagine becomes a kind of device, an enabling device, an opiating device, whereas Help, it's the blast of cold water, not just in the face, but in the soul.
In terms of Imagine, though, Colin, can the piece of art, through the interpretation of listeners or viewers or readers, exceed and help that art exceed its actual original quality? Does the fact that so many people love that song and find inspiration in it make it greater than it actually is?
No, I don't think so. I think things are what they are. They have their own actual value. And I like Imagine. Someone said to me today, they wrote me and they said, I also hate Imagine. I don't hate Imagine. I think it's tuneful. I think it's fine. A blog is going up in a little bit that likens it to Paul McCartney's, it ended up on a solo record, but he was tooling around with it during the White Album sessions called Junk. It later became Sing-Along Junk. And it's this tuneful, it's actually more haunting. I find it more of an arresting piece of music. But I think what happens a lot of times is we are so circumscribed in our purview that we don't look very far. And when you don't look very far, to use kind of a cheap analogy, you can think that the Big Mac is gourmet dining. And that's not what it is. That might just be all that you know. And all that you know doesn't mean, I've heard Help. I know it. It's not the same as knowing something. It's not the same as partaking of it fully, immersively, being completely in the moment of someone else's art so that you can have your own moment that's going to play a role in your own life going forward. So it's like people, I'm sure there are people out there who read like Daniel Steele and they're like, oh, it's the best thing ever. Well, it's not.
You point out, too, that as of 1965, Help was the loudest Beatles song that had come along. And yet, as you say, Lennon's voice cuts through everything.
It starts with that shout, really, right? It starts with that announcement. It's that declaration of one word. Not just one word, but one syllable. And when you think about when you cry out in life, like if you scream or it's in a horror film or anything, and you'll notice that most of the times it's a single syllable word. There's a kind of primalcy about that. And so it was a single, and it was also the first song on the album. So you just enjoyed A Hard Day's Night for Yourself and all these Lennon McCartney originals, the only Beatles record, just entirely Lennon McCartney originals. And you have this guy shouting at you. And it's amazing that it's so loud too, because a lot of it is powered by the rhythm guitar, which is an acoustic guitar. Then you have Harrison crashing in with these accentuating guitar chords that are used at the same place in the song throughout, but it's not like there's a solo. It's not like there's a huge buzz-toned riff. It's the acoustic guitar. It's this fusillade of drums. It's that electric guitar fill, really. But it's mostly Lennon's voice. It is an intense jangle coming at you.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move from John Lennon to what's become a holiday favorite, but first recorded for the film Meet Me in St. Louis, Judy Garland's version of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
I love Judy Garland so much. I think she's one of the great, I call her a jazz singer. No one else does. I think she's one of the great jazz singers like Ella Fitzgerald or Billie Holiday. And technically, she's a better singer even than Ella Fitzgerald. Billie Holiday wasn't technically that great of a singer. She could do things with her voice emotionally that really perhaps these other two singers couldn't. But Judy Garland, and I was just before you called, I was listening to her when she was 15 actually. It was 1937. It's on YouTube. She sings this version of Silent Night, and she just had it. She came out, there's very few artists do this, where they come along, they arrive fully formed. Judy Garland was that way. Of course, she was 16, did Wizard of Oz in 1939. But this, I think this is the finest popular music Christmas song there is. And it is a bluesy song. It's not that much of an upbeat song, but it's not really a downer of a song. And she sings this with technical perfection and emotional heft that you don't really get. Like, it's not Feliz Navidad.
No, there's a darkness there to the lyrics that would be sanitized often in cover versions through the years. She sings, until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. Mm-hmm. And then that's not the lyrics that were often used in a more contemporary versions.
That is just one of the most potent verbs in the history of mid-century songwriting, don't you think? Muddle.
Mm.
And she gives it such power. And Frank Sinatra later says, when he wants to do his version of the song, he goes and he's like, oh, can you change this for me? I don't want to have it. It's just too much a dirge-like, this whole muddle thing. And her voice uses a lot of vibrato. And when you use vibrato, it keeps music moving forward, which it sounds like it shouldn't be able to do because you're tone painting on a given note, on a given syllable or whatever it is. But Judy Garland was always able to use vibrato to move forward. So you're not like stuck in that mud of muddle. It flows. And it's a letter song in a way, because in the film, Judy Garland's character is singing it to her 5-year-old sister. Mm. They don't want to move from this happy place that they have in St. Louis. And makes an absurd amount of sense when you think about it. It was huge with GIs overseas when they were hearing the song of, they didn't have to be from St. Louis, obviously, but it took balls to sing that song. I don't mean like masculine balls. I mean metaphorical balls. Be like, this is the Christmas song, and to own it as this shaded and blue blues.
And there's so much depth to the vocal in it, and we hear this a few times in pop music history where someone so young seems to have an understanding of the depth of a song that belies their age.
There is a charming version from December 17th, 1944. So Meet Me in St. Louis comes out in November of 1944. Judy Garland did about 30 radio appearances where she's singing her various songs over the years, and she does the trolley song, which anyone out there, if you know that song, my mere mentioning of that will put that in your head, and you'll be going around tonight going ding ding goes the trolley,
clang 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 goes the trolley.
Yeah.
thanks for that.
Yeah, she does Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And it's funny because when she introduces it, it's like still sufficiently new that she doesn't say the title correctly. She says Have Yourself a Merry Christmas. She leaves out the little. You think like the studio version, and I don't want to denigrate the studio version anyway, but listen to the first ever live performance of this, and you're going to think that someone can't sing that well just live, just doing it. Like, you're at the radio, there's the microphone, walk over. There's no modern day studio trickery or click tracks or anything like that. To say it's note perfect would be to insult the level of this performance.
One of the things I love about talking with you, Colin, is that you always make me do some research, which I like, and learn a little. And this week it was a song that I have apparently listened to mindlessly since I was a kid and had no idea of the backstory of Good King Wenceslas.
Oh, you didn't know the history there of this. Good King Wenceslas is one of my favorite carols, and like our discussion with favorite smells and favorite animals, by the way, regarding the former one I left out, pine, right? I don't know how I did that, especially you. You should be ashamed of yourself. You live in Maine. You should mention pine. And Good King Wenceslas is, I find it inspirational, and anyone who kind of knows my situation right now would understand why that's the case. It's about a Bohemian king, and he is taking his page, kind of like his right-hand man, sort of like his assistant, out into the snow to deliver alms to the poor. And it's freezing out. Snow's whipping around, and the page starts to have this like frostbite setting in. And they're trying to do this service for people. And Good King Wenceslas, he says, follow in my footsteps. And, of course, it's a metaphor. And he said, the footsteps that the page then puts his own feet in, trailing behind his king, are warming, and they go straight through him, and he's fine, and he's able to continue on with this journey. It's really a song about giving of yourself and helping and inspiring others, and it's inescapable. Like, people hear it all the time. It's from 1853, and it's interesting, too, for a Christmas carol to be through composed, which is what this song is. And if people don't know what through composed means, you're essentially getting no repetition. So we just talked about help. Help is not through composed because you get the chorus repeating a few times or however many times this. Good King Wenceslas, you don't have that. It unfurls, like when we were talking about Dylan before. So most Christmas carols sort of pin a lot of their effect on the chorus. And that's not what Good King Wenceslas does. In other words, so when it's moving in that through composed manner, it's like walking. When you walk, you're not backtracking. You're always moving forward. So you have that dovetailing of the sound and the sense, which is something like someone like Handel could have heard and said, oh, yeah, I totally get what you are doing there, John Mason Neal, who was the lyric writer of the song.
Finally, the only regret I had in listening to the radio show that you shared with me, an early 1933 radio broadcast called The Christmas Eve Ghost. I listened to it early this morning, was totally captivated with it, but then I really thought that needs best be listened to at about, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock on a snowy night, but it was wonderful.
Yeah, and it's from the early days of radio. It's 1933. It's like a ship off the coast of Maine, and it's almost like folk art, wouldn't you say? Because it's not what we expect, even like in the next decade when radio gets pretty professional. Things get pretty professional with Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater and all of that. This sounds like they just got some guys. Like, you're like, right? They went down to the Rotary Club. And they're like, who wants to be in the radio special tonight? This will rock. And so you have this captain, sea captain, and he's not far from land. That's important. Maine, the coast of Maine. And he's out there. And he's reading that part in the Bible where, lo, the shepherds came, all of that, the stuff that Linus really digs.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because as I listened to it, I had the thought, I wonder if maybe Charles Schulz listened to this as a young man and was inspired and realized the power of that verse.
What's interesting, too, is Orson Welles, like, no one knows this particular recording. I'll send you a link, but Orson Welles does a reading of the same material for a Christmas episode. So the guy's in there, he's like, really, the captain's really into this portion of the Bible. And one of the mates comes in, and the captain is like pissed because the guy's not listening reverentially enough. And it's funny how dismissive the mate is. The captain's like, don't you love this? And the guy's like, no. Like, he just sounds like a bratty teenager. Finally, the mate delivers his news that the parson that the captain keeps on ship, because he's so religious, has been shot on land. So they go, he's like, oh, no, what did you tell me earlier, man? The guy's like, oh, I tried to, but just reading that and all that Bible stuff. So they go to the room, and the parson's dying, this extended death scene, and the parson hears all of this music, and he's like, I will come back this time next year. I'm going right now. And the captain's like, no, it's fine. Walk it off. Don't sweat it. And the parson, he expires. So the ship later, I guess everyone's off of it. You have to sort of like fill in that blank for yourself. The ship burns, and the captain comes the next year, and he comes with his handicapped son who can't walk. He has crutches. And the wise-ass mate shows up too, and he's like, you believe he'll come back? And the mate's like, no, I'm here to laugh at everybody when they see that he doesn't. So the parson comes back, and no one can see him or hear him. Yeah. The ghost doesn't really resonate with anyone, so he has to do something. Could probably guess what that is, to prove that he came back and saved a certain day.
And it's so simple, very, very limited sound effects, and yet incredibly powerful.
Yeah, it's like that just primal cave art, the radio version of cave art from the dawn of this juggernaut of an entertainment form. Maybe we don't think of it that way now, but radio, I find this more and more as I get older, too. There is so much art that happened on the radio that is like legitimate, canonical, like Charles Dickens-type level art. And this is someone who's not at that level, and his team isn't at that level. But you'll get these examples of art out there, folk art, pottery, whatever it is. You can see at the MFA. that is just when Alan Lomax would go around and record field hands, right, and their spirituals and their folk songs. It is like the Christmas radio broadcast version of that. And it was made, interestingly enough, too, for a William Randolph Hearst magazine.
Right.
So you have like all of this, like Orson Welles, it's like a few years later. But that was part of the Hearst empire, that you could just take this squib from a magazine and turn it into this 15-minute radio thing. And people tuned in because of where it came from.
Well, the Christmas Eve Ghost is out there on YouTube. Check it out. I plan on re-listening, I think, late on Christmas Eve. And there's something about that. Something about radio, to me, just lends itself so well to the telling of these Christmas stories.
No, I couldn't agree more, because it makes you rely on your imagination. And I think Christmas is the imagination holiday.
A Christmas gift for your best friend, your pal, or even for yourself would be to grab a hold of Colin's wonderful new book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Get that wherever fine books are sold. Colin, we thank you as always. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good, bud.
Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown.